Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. So today we have David Gardenstein-Ross on the show again, and he recently had an article that was released in the Washington Post, and it was about jihadist governance, and the dilemmas that face jihadists when they create these Islamic states like we have had recently in Iraq. So we're going to kind of tackle this issue. It's a very interesting issue, and there's a lot of things at play. For those that might not have listened to our talks with David before, he is the senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies here in Washington, D.C., and he's also an author of numerous books, but I will say that his recent one, Bin Laden's Legacy, is a great read, as well as My Year Inside Radical Islam. So, first of all, welcome to the show, David.
Thanks. It's great to join you.
So, jihadist governance. You made a great quote in your article. And you said, jihadists are afflicted by a fundamental dilemma. They cannot attain their goals if they don't govern, yet the records show them repeatedly failing at governance efforts. So that says a lot right there. So why don't we open up with that and let's hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, to me, that represents something which I've long referred to as the paradox of jihadist power, which is that when they appear strongest, that's when their greatest weakness is exposed. I think that governance really is the fatal flaw in jihadist efforts. And the reason why is because they're fundamentally committed, as a matter of ideology, to trying to establish states and to rule those states in a specific way, according to an extreme version of Sharia or Islamic law. And when they do so, the consequences for them are not good. It generates resentment internally, and we can already see that resentment cropping up in Iraq. In Mosul over the weekend, you had four members of the Islamic State get assassinated. There's been the formation of rebel groups, and ultimately these groups might get crushed. But you can see that the discontent has already resulted in violent resistance to the Islamic State's rule over Mosul. And secondly, in addition to these internal problems and internal uprisings that they might face, they also face external legitimacy problems, not just because their governance is viewed as illegitimate, but because when jihadist groups actually control territory, then the threat posed by these organizations, the threat of terrorism, the threat of instability spreading, becomes much more acute for surrounding states. And so you get a wide number of states, all of whom may have conflicts with each other, but you'll get a wide number of states that cooperate to push these groups out, and that consistently happens. That happened in Somalia, where you had Ethiopia and Kenya and African Union forces work together. That happened in Mali, where you had the French working with ECOWAS, which is a community of West African states. And that's now happening in Iraq, where you have ISIS, or rather the Islamic State, hated by basically everybody surrounding them. Iran hates them and has devoted special operations forces to fighting them. Syria, of course, hates them, and Assad has finally started bombing the Islamic State. The Iraqi government is fighting them, and now their own coalition partners are starting to fight them as well, which gives an indication of just how illegitimate groups like the Islamic State are seen as when they start to gain power. So their greatest weakness can actually be found during times of strength.
I know some of our previous guests in our Iraq series and Islamic State series have alluded to this idea that the Islamic State is in a period where they can either greatly expand or crash and burn, you could say. And it seems like from what you said, they're having a lot of negative feedback from creating this caliphate in their mind. And it might not be very sustainable for them to keep the state going. And looking at this issue, in your article, you talk about sustainability and what they will need to create the so-called state, basic things like water, oil, governance issues. So why don't we look at this in more detail?
Yeah, I define their challenges as falling into three categories: legitimacy, effectiveness, and sustainability. Legitimacy, we've already talked about. Legitimacy is, internally people finding their rule so illegitimate that they rise up against it, and then, you know, external states responding. Effectiveness deals with the issues that you talked about, you know, making sure that trash is collected, that social services are provided if those services existed previously, that the water is running, that electricity is provided. And the Islamic State, as it's expanded, has made an effort to really show that it provides services right at the outset. So if they capture a town which previously didn't have good trash collection, they'll go around and collect the trash, but it's harder for them to do that over the longer term, right? It's easy to make a show at the very outset that you're going to make people's lives better and do some stuff that they're not used to. But it's harder to sustain that, especially when you're a group like the Islamic State, where the top leadership of this group is fundamentally, they want to govern, they want to build states, but they're fundamentally, not as interested in doing that as fighting. That's one problem. The other problem is that when they capture territory, right away, the government's going to shut off payments to civil servants, which creates another dilemma for them. Most of the civil servants have not been paid, and given that the Islamic State is much more interested in fighting than anything else, they don't have the array of civil servants that are there. They don't have the people, for example, with the oil fields that they've captured. It's not clear from the sources that I've spoken to. It seems that the Islamic State does not have people who are really trained technicians who can extract oil from the fields, that instead they need to capture technicians and have them do the work for them. That makes it difficult for them to provide effective governance over a longer term, and that folds into the final issue which I mentioned, that of sustainability. Groups like the Islamic State have been able to capture territory and hold it for somewhat extended periods. You've had jihadist groups also take over in the past 13 years most of southern Somalia in the case of al-Shabaab, northern Mali in the case of al-Qaeda and Islamic Maghreb, parts of Yemen in the case of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and previously a large swath of Anbar province in the form of al-Qaeda in Iraq, who's the predecessor of the Islamic State. All of those are previous examples of jihadist governance. And in all of those cases, it ended up not lasting for very long. The reason why is because of all the problems that they're afflicted with, which conspire to ensure that these groups can govern for some time and they can control territory for some time, but it's very difficult for them to maintain it.
And in those past cases, which example lasted the longest as far as governing the region?
The one that lasted the longest of the ones I mentioned is Somalia, where Shabaab had captured a lot of territory by 2009 and continued to hold urban strongholds through the end of 2012. They actually continue to control territory to this day. They just don't control any major urban territory. So for me, in my Washington Post piece that you mentioned, I count the end of jihadist rule in Somalia at 2012. And one of my Somali contacts debated me about that a little bit, and I agree with that. What I said is I was just counting it to the end of the fall of Kismayo, which ended them having any urban strongholds. But they do continue to control smaller territory to this day. So that is by far the longest lasting of these examples.
And in the Somali case, what has been their success in having the longest hold of governance?
Well, I wouldn't call their governance itself more successful. I would say, experienced by far the most dramatic failure, which is in the 2011 to 2012 period, the Horn of Africa was hit by a major drought. It was described as the worst drought that the Horn of Africa had experienced in 60 years. Some people who know the Horn very well dispute that characterization. But at any rate, it was the worst drought that had existed in quite some time. Very, very bad. And in the midst of the drought, Shabaab ended up kicking aid organizations out of the areas that it controlled, claiming that those organizations were both trying to spread secularism and also spread Christianity. And so the aid providers were expelled at the very time that they faced a possible humanitarian catastrophe. And so that drought ended up deepening into a famine in the areas of Somalia that Shabaab controlled. This was a major governance failure, and you saw these really brutal, disgusting images of Shabaab fighters taking fleeing environmental refugees, people who were trying to get to areas that were not beset by famine, and driving them back to famine-stricken areas. That's something that was not successfully exploited by Shabaab's enemies, but represented an enormous failure on Shabaab's part. But the reason why I think that they've been able to control territory longer there comes down to two things. Number one, Somalia had been in an anarchic situation. It had been beset by anarchy for quite some time. And for that reason, two things were true. One is the rule of Shabaab's predecessor, the Islamic Courts Union, looked pretty good for quite some time in comparison to what had existed previously. You can see the same phenomenon with the Taliban's rise in Afghanistan, that they might represent brutal justice, but at least they represent some sort of justice and some sort of order. That was one thing that worked in their favor. And there's a second aspect of anarchy that also helped them, which is that as a result of having had a decade and a half of anarchy by the time the Islamic courts and then Shabaab rose to power, you didn't have a tradition of a strong central government, which meant that for a lot of the more rural areas, the areas that Shabaab still has some control over, it's not necessarily typical, at least not since the fall of the Siad Barre regime, for the central government to extend its writ into those areas. Thus, that allows Shabaab to hold it for a longer time. So that's the first reason, anarchy. The second reason is that the military that opposed them isn't as competent as the military was in some of these other locations. I mean, the military, there's been no Western intervention in Somalia. It was initially Ethiopians. The Kenyans have gotten involved, and also what's called AMISOM, the African Union Mission to Somalia. Whereas in northern Mali, that was a French-led intervention. In Iraq, with al-Qaeda in Iraq, of course, that was, the U.S. took the lead in responding. With Yemen, you didn't have a Western-led intervention, although you have had U.S. bombings in Yemen. But I think those are the factors which have allowed Shabaab greater success, which I think stem from some of the particularities of the situation, as opposed to real governance successes on Shabaab's part.
Mm-hmm. So going back to the Islamic State, and with the al-Shabaab case, you talk about the military competence. Let's look at the Iraqi military and how that has played for or against the Islamic State and creating this caliphate.
No, it's played for 100%, with no question, no equivocation. During their initial offensive, it wasn't clear that they thought they would gain all that they could. What happened was you had the Iraqi military melt away. I mean, they've definitely been helped by a couple of factors, one of which is the Iraqi military being so ineffective. A second factor is that in Syria, the Assad regime has concentrated far more of its military resources on fighting against other rebel factions rather than the Islamic State. And the reason why is both Machiavellian and also rather smart. Quite simply, the Assad regime wanted to make sure that the rebels looked as unattractive as possible to outside states. And so Assad hasn't concentrated much military resources until recently on the Islamic State, and it has concentrated few military resources as well on fighting against Kurdish rebel groups. Not because, like, the U.S. and Western states are afraid of Kurds, but states in the region are. Right? Syria borders Turkey, which has had which has extraordinary fears of Kurdish control of this area. They have their own problem with a Kurdish separatist group known as the PKK, which has been a very bloody conflict. Then you have Iraq, or the Kurdish region of Iraq, and Iraq has its own concerns about the Kurds wanting to split their state, get independence from the Iraqi state, which would have the effect of really harming Iraq's oil revenues. So when the Islamic State, when Assad makes this decision not to fight the Islamic State, not to fight the Kurds, it really is to help ensure his own regime's survival, and that you want your regime, you want your opposition to look a lot like those groups and a lot less like the FSA.
So going back to the idea of the Islamic State once again, fighting versus state building, and you said that's a huge player, a key player in this issue. What could the Islamic State do? I mean, they have a lot of opposition, so they do need to keep fighting, but what could they do to focus more on the state building? Do they have enough resources in a sense of people to separate this, or are they too small to focus on both of these things at the same time?
Well, you can focus on both of them, but you know, there's a few obstacles that they face. I mean, the first obstacle is one they're not going to overcome, and one that even more moderate jihadist groups are going to have great trouble overcoming. But the first one is that they're too ideological and implement an extraordinarily extreme version of Islamic law, which is inherently alienating. I mean, they've basically driven Christians out of Mosul. Like, it's extraordinary. And that's out of step with what the Iraqi people want and are used to, right? The fact that they've driven Christians out of Mosul is not something that Iraqis are applauding, other than very extreme individuals who would gravitate towards the Islamic State anyway. And the Islamic State is probably the least pragmatic jihadist group in the world today. If you look at their propaganda, they are openly documenting war crimes that they're committing. You have these disgusting bozos appearing, putting selfies on Twitter where they're holding severed heads and smiling at the camera. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's remarkable. They're openly documenting war crimes. That is not a pragmatic organization. And so when it comes to that fundamental governance problem of being too ideological, too brutal, they just have a problem that they're not trying to deal with at all. Now, in contrast, Al-Qaeda has actually tried to deal with that. If you look at some of the letters that Rukmini Kalamachi found in northern Mali, documenting the governance that Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb tried to implement there, you have, for example, the head of that organization, of AKIM, saying that it's a mistake to implement Sharia too quickly, that we shouldn't be surprised that people for whom the previous government didn't teach them true Islam and suppress true Islam don't know it. So we have to slowly introduce Islam to these people. Now, in practice, they failed at doing that. They failed at the slow implementation. They still went too quickly, but they were at least aware that there was a problem and tried to address it. Whereas the Islamic State, had slowed down their implementation of Sharia in Mosul by a little bit, but not by a whole hell of a lot. Now, the second problem is the resource problem. And in terms of resources, yeah, you can focus on both. And the way they've tried to focus on it is basically by either buying or else threatening civil servants and technicians to stay on with them. And, their services provision, in some places, it reportedly continues to be better than it used to be. In other places, you clearly have economic difficulties that have already crept in under their rule. But to me, it's the first part that's the real problem. Or let me put it differently. The first part is the problem they cannot get over. The economic problem is the resource problem is one that inherently exists, in part because for all these areas, they're not going to have a stable state. They're going to have a state that is constantly under attack, and they're trying to undertake state building at the very same time that they're trying to fight a war. And that's just going to be the case for the Islamic State moving forward.
I guess if you would look at it from the Islamic State's point of view and this whole idea of a pragmatic organization, they have their own idea of Islam and how to implement that. And as everyone that has been following this knows, it's a very violent form. And it's not Islam per se, it's their interpretation of Islam. So let's make that very clear. And we're seeing this idea of implementing Sharia law And it's a very brutal form of Sharia law. We're seeing amputation of hands and the strange Twitter photos that were coming out of mannequins' faces being covered, destruction of shrines and graves because they're considered signs of polytheism. So let's talk about that a little bit. And this implementation of extreme Sharia law very quickly, you could say.
Sure. What do you want to know about it?
Well, let's just look at this. I mean, because it is a violent form of rule, but
yeah,
and there in their minds, this is the caliphate they're creating. This is their way of creating order. So, I mean, you could look at it from their point of view as this is their way of creating justice and order within a society. Not that anyone agrees with that, not that I agree with that, but I'm just throwing that out there.
Right. Look, that's definitely where they're coming from. That's also where Al-Qaeda is coming from. And this is where I think their lack of pragmatism becomes, you know, so apparent. You know, Al-Qaeda, you know, one of the most violent, vicious organizations in the world, recognizes this problem and is trying to adapt. Now, again, let me emphasize, I don't think they're adapting successfully, but they are trying to adapt. Whereas the Islamic State just doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even for a jihadist organization, they are extraordinarily non-pragmatic. And part of this, it's interesting. There's a debate right now, and you know, it's a debate which, as with a lot of my debates, I'm in the minority, but will be absolutely proven right over time, at which point everyone will pretend that they agreed with me all the time. But there's a debate amongst kind of experts and analysts about which, you know, what is the premier jihadist organization? I believe that Al-Qaeda has the most going for them. That if you, in 3 to 5 years' time, you know, the Islam, that Al-Qaeda will be seen as more of a threat than the Islamic State is. You know, most people would fall in the other camp. And look, there's something legitimate to be said for both views here. But the reason why I think Al-Qaeda is the better bet for being a long-term adversary is because they're pragmatic. You know, they went through this problem where their brand was very much dimmed by the brutality that they'd inflicted upon other Muslims. And incidentally, the predecessor of the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, was responsible for a lot of that brutality, which ended up dimming their brand.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, you can see that there's been a lot of evolution. Zawahiri's latest guidelines for jihad try to emphasize minimizing civilian casualties, minimizing overt brutality, and things like that. Whereas the Islamic State is very much in the model of Zarqawi, who led Al-Qaeda in Iraq. You know, they're openly beheading people. Guys are posing with severed heads, as I mentioned. Just a very overtly brutal organization. And one of the reasons their brand is considered to be a strong brand right now by some counterterrorism analysts is because they have basically attracted the youth vote within the jihadist movement. That is, kind of impetuous young men who have this romanticized view of violence. And they certainly have attracted that youth vote. No question about that. But ultimately, the youth vote didn't sustain Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And I think that you can't really build, you know, a successful global organization out of, like, young 20-year-olds who have trouble distinguishing between a video game and, like, actually brutalizing and killing people. And that's kind of what their constituency is. So they're going to remain strong. And, you know, in 3 to 5 years' time, it wouldn't surprise me if they were still the strongest organization in Iraq and Syria. Although it wouldn't surprise me if they'd been surpassed either. But globally, you know, this brutality is not going to sustain a continued upward trajectory, especially if they experience battlefield reversals.
So looking at Al-Qaeda, do you think that potentially the Islamic State down the line might follow the example of Al-Qaeda being more flexible? So say you've got all these young people that are joining the jihad, as you said, Islamic State really focuses on the young blood, so to speak. These young people, if they survive, if they stay in the Islamic State organization, they're going to age a bit, older, wiser, so to speak. So do you think they might follow this example of Al-Qaeda down the line and become more pragmatic, more flexible, to survive as a group.
Certainly. It's possible that they'll become more pragmatic. And you know, if they do, like Al-Qaeda, they'll have to go through an adjustment period. And let me just emphasize one thing, which is we're talking about relative degrees of pragmatism, right? Al-Qaeda is still not a pragmatic organization, but relative to the Islamic State, they sure are. And one thing that Al-Qaeda may be thinking about is how they can use the Islamic State's raw brutality to bolster their own brand.
Very much so. And I think we're actually kind of starting to see that, aren't we?
Maybe. Certainly, when people look at Nusra versus the Islamic State, there are many within the region who consider Nusra to be a moderate organization because it's not the Islamic State. And it's worked well with other rebel groups, very well compared to the Islamic State. I mean, while the Islamic State fights everybody, literally fights everybody, Nusra hasn't tried to dominate other rebels, and so has worked with them pretty well. So they have somewhat of a successful rebrand within Iraq and Syria. Whether that can carry over to other parts of the world, we haven't really seen yet. But that's something I would look for, because if they're able to actually start to rebrand themselves as more moderate based on the comparison with the Islamic State, I think that is going to be a very dangerous thing.
So I know you have a time constraint, and we want to wrap this up so that you can get to where you need to be going. So let's just have a conclusion on this. Where does this leave the Islamic State at in this time period and maybe potentially further ahead?
Well, let me emphasize, the jihadist governance dilemma is a jihadist governance dilemma. It's not just the Islamic State's dilemma. This is a problem not only for the Islamic State, but also for Al-Qaeda and for all other jihadist groups who might come to govern. And what I think is that the Islamic State is at the apex of its power, but really let's look beyond that. I think the question Western policymakers should be asking is how can they exploit this vulnerability? You know, their rule is brutal. It's going to continue to be brutal. These guys are openly documenting war crimes. So if you look at previous examples of jihadist governance, Al-Qaeda in Iraq ruled Anbar province brutally. It caused an uprising that overthrew them. But we didn't do a great job. The U.S. and other Western countries did not do a great job of broadcasting that, of showing just how awful life was under that vicious organization. I mean, this is there should be more effective information operations based upon things like this, especially when the Islamic State's war crimes are being documented openly. I think what Westerners need to think about, this is absolutely a weakness that exists. So we should ask, how can we better exploit this weakness moving forward?
Looking at that, though, what pops into my mind is when you mentioned the Islamic State blatantly documenting these war crimes with photos and posts on Twitter and Facebook and so forth, the only thing that kind of, to me, gives it a catch-22 is, yes, they are, but if they're going to create this state and it survives and it flourishes, they're clearly going to think that they're above international law, UN, and so forth. So how do you implement that then? How do you implement enforcing war crimes and justice?
Oh, I'm not saying that they're going to be subservient to the international community. And at the end of the day, there are a wide variety of states that commit war crimes and are not held accountable for it, or other kinds of major humanitarian crimes. Think of the Syria and the Assad regime, North Korea. So my argument isn't that international law can be used. What I mean is they are documenting what they do, and it is brutal. They are openly beheading people and posing with their heads. They are executing people who have surrendered. And so I'm not saying, how do we bring them before the Hague? I'm saying, how do we diminish their brand as quickly as possible, show people how bad they are, and in that sense, weaken them by encouraging those who might be on the fence to understand that they actually need to resist this organization and to resist its advances now.
And I would love to give you a chance to make a final statement, but that to me sounds like a fantastic way to end the show. I mean, if you think otherwise, please let me know, but that really says a lot right there.
I'm happy with that as a final statement.
So there you go. Well, thank you so much for spending the time with us today and talking about this, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Look forward to it.